Coming up next from the grassy knoll, a terrifying look into the Orwellian world of brainwashing, disinformation, and ultimately control over
you.
And this will be The Road to Orwell, Part 7. This is based on a book by Ian Slater, Orwell, The Road to Airstrip 1. And what I'm going to do is, for this particular segment, I'll finish up what remains of Chapter 10. And then there will be a final Chapter 11, which I just, 9, 10, and 11 were just absolutely chock-filled with what I consider some great stuff about Orwell. And kind of sorry to see it come to an end, but then we're going to hunt down Ian Slater, which I've already kind of got a beat on, whether or not he'll come on and speak to this, which I think would be kind of interesting, not only for his remembrances of when he wrote it in the mid-80s, but also now what he thinks about it, you know, these 21 years later, 22 years later. So we'll see how that goes. Well, here we go, finishing up Chapter 10. From Orwell, The Road to Airstrip 1. We got done in the last part, at the end of Part 6, with basically Winston just copping out on Julia when he... and we'll finish with that last line of the paragraph, which I last read for Part 6, and it says, "As the pink hands and whiskers of one of the rats press against the wire, Winston screams, 'Don't do it, Julia! Do it to Julia! Do it to Julia! Julia, not me, not me.'" All right. So, you know, obviously, he copped. And here we go with the rest of Chapter 10. "At this moment, the lingering vestiges of individual pride and dignity are extinguished forever in Winston Smith. O'Brien has cured him of rebellion. He has, as promised, made Winston sane. Winston now belongs totally to the party. Released, he's a walking zombie awaiting death, the bullet in the back of the neck that will surely come. Having satisfied the party, having fallen subservient to the terror that the party uses, not for the accumulation of wealth, but for the sheer intoxication of power, constantly increasing and constantly growing subtler, Winston is left alone after his public confessions to await his end quietly, drinking his victory gin, his mind back in the ministry of love. With everything forgiven, his soul as white as snow, he gazes up at the enormous poster of the leader. For 40 years it had taken him to learn what kind of smile was hidden behind the dark mustache. Oh, cruel, needless misunderstanding. Oh, stubborn, self-willed exile from the loving breast. 2 gin-scented tears trickled down the sides of his nose. But it was all right. Everything was all right. The struggle was finished. He had won the victory over himself. He loved Big Brother." So Smith's destruction is the final illustration of what Orwell, in 1944, considered to be one of the most dangerous fallacies in non-totalitarian countries, the belief, like that of Dorothy Hare, that under a dictatorship you can be free inside. It is the belief that despite the face of the leader, 4 feet wide, glaring all about you, up in the attics the secret enemies of the regime, like Smith, can record their thoughts in perfect freedom. It is a belief, writes Orwell, that does not take into account the fundamental horror of isolation, does not understand that if the foe had really lived on a desert island, he could not have written Robinson Crusoe, nor would he have wanted to. Winston's diary did not keep him from free inside. At best, it was only temporarily therapeutic. No matter who you are, Winston, as in Churchill, or Smith, as in the common man, you will break. Finally, what Orwell tells us is that quite apart from the more efficient use of terror and totalitarian methods of deception that help to undermine the desire for intellectual liberty, there is a much more insidious power at work. Though not realized by Dorothy Hare, Winston Smith, or the painter who told Orwell in 1944 that he would be a pacifist under a German occupation, quote, "so that I can get on with my work," End of quote. The fundamental enemy of intellectual freedom, says Orwell, is the attempt to isolate oneself from one's fellows. The occasional need for solitude notwithstanding, he argues that while it is possible to work without thinking, it is almost impossible to think without talking, which implies the company of others. Of course, once you talk, you expose your thoughts. In a totalitarian society, this means putting your political freedom at risk, for you do not know what thoughts will follow. Moreover, because those in power do not know what will follow, they will try to forestall heresies by refusing to declare any subject politically neutral, as exemplified by Stalin's and Hitler's pronouncements on decadent art. If there is no neutral ground, even in the state's view of art, you are either for or against the state. On the one hand, Orwell argues the risk of communicating with your fellows must be taken if your intellectual and political freedom, and ultimately your humanity, is to have any chance of survival. Yet the story of Winston Smith, who tried to live in his own world for a time, but then sought the uninhibited company of Julia, though one of bravery, is ultimately one of defeat. The totality of his defeat is captured in the sentence, "He loved Big Brother." For Orwell, however, all is not lost to the totalitarian state. As the animals, unaware of their collective strength, had inspired Orwell to write Animal Farm, Winston Smith is inspired to write that, quote, "If there is hope, it lies in the proles," end of quote. It is a return to Orwell's faith in the virtues of the working class, but the question for those in the servitude of the totalitarian state is, what evidence is there for such faith? Orwell argues that the proles in 1984 do have weapons with which to fight the totalitarian state, whether or not they realize it. The first is their numerical superiority. Physically, they are capable of rebellion as the whipped animals that had inspired Animal Farm. Constituting 85% of the population, they needed only to rise up and shake themselves like a horse shaking off flies. If they choose, they could blow the party to pieces tomorrow morning. The problem, however, is that the proles fail to realize their potential for revolt. The problem is a lack of any kind of political consciousness, and until they become conscious, they will never rebel, and until after they have rebelled, they cannot become conscious. Politically, they are the direct descendants of the coal miners of Wigan. It was not desirable that the proles should have strong political feelings. All that was required of them was a primitive patriotism which could be appealed to whatever it was necessary to make them accept, longer working hours or shorter rations. Unlike members of the party, however, the proles' consciousness is not deliberately blunted by active ideological indoctrination, at least not by anything beyond the standard newscasts. Rather, it is blunted by the party's perpetuation of what Orwell sees as the ancestral rut of the poorest British worker. They were born, they grew up in the gutters, they went to work at 12, they passed through a brief blossoming period of beauty and sexual desire. They married at 20, they were middle-aged at 30, they died, for the most part, at 60. Heavy physical work, the care of home and children, petty quarrels with neighbors, films, football, beer, and above all, gambling, filled up the horizon of their minds. It is as if the early sections of the Road to Wigan Pier have been transported to the world of Airstrip 1. Even in Victory Mansions, the haunting image of the haggard, old-before-her-time housewife in Wigan reappears as we are introduced to Mrs. Parsons, a woman with lined face and wispy hair, fiddling helplessly with a blocked waste pipe. Still, there is hope. Just as the party fails to realize the potential of verse as a subversive weapon, insofar as traditional rhyme forms can bring to mind alternative ways of life, it likewise fails to see the danger inherent in allowing the proles to gamble. While gambling may blunt political consciousness of inequality by offering prizes as a soap to the underprivileged and offering them hope of bettering their lot, the very presence of the concept of luck, of accident, runs counter to the concept of infallible planning by an infallible party. It may well be, of course, that until ministries of information and totalitarian governments perfect their methods of deception, of being able to rationalize everything that happens, including the failure of five-year plans, the government will tolerate the belief in luck as a convenient explanation of those events that contradict the state's supposed infallibility. The danger to the state, however, is that though the concepts of luck and planning may reasonably coexist, the belief in luck, even if it does not erode belief in any person's supposed political infallibility, may well suggest the idea of a reality beyond the control of the state. If ever this were to become widely held, then the power, if not the infallibility, of the state would most likely be widely questioned. Therein lies the seeds of rebellion. As in the case of the revolutionary potential of verse, however, the question in 1984 is how, if ever, the prose will become conscious enough to recognize and organize against the massive deceit that is being worked upon them. Indeed, they may not. The prognosis of 1984 is not good. But if there is hope in this matter, it lies in something that the proles have that no one else in Airstrip 1 possesses. And this is a strong sense of loyalty. This is not a public loyalty, not a loyalty to the party that has to adapt to each new policy, but a fixed loyalty to each other. By contrast, the party members are marked by a lack of simple friendship for each other and by an acceptance of cruelty that reveals a divorce between the heart and mind that George Bowling feared would mark the streamlined men from modern Europe. This difference between the proletarian and party members, between the low and the middle-high strata of society, is demonstrated early in the novel, when Smith describes the outrage with which a prole mother objects to a particularly bloody and violent movie scene. And here we go to the text of the book. There was a wonderful shot of a child's arm going up, 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 right into the air. A helicopter with a camera in its nose must have followed it up, and there was a lot of applause from the party seats. But a woman down in the prole part of the house suddenly started kicking up a fuss and shouting they didn't order of showed it in front of the kids. Until the police turned her out, I don't suppose anything happened to her. Nobody cares what the proles say. Typical prole reaction. That's the end of the excerpt. Similarly for Winston Smith, the party member, the song he heard, is nothing more than some lines turned over from a versificator, without any human intervention whatever. But the proles quickly adopt it, and the washerwoman near Winston and Julia's hideaway infuses it with such emotion that for Winston she turns the dreadful rubbish into an almost pleasant sound. It struck him as a curious fact that he had never heard a member of the party singing alone and spontaneously. It would even have seemed slightly unorthodox, a dangerous eccentricity, like talking to oneself. It is the recurrence of this song, the fact that it outlives the hate song, that makes us realize why hope lies in the proles. Unlike a party member who is expected to have no private emotions, the prole has preserved the old emotions, such as personal loyalty, and this keeps the prole class more human than the party. Again, another excerpt. They had not become hardened inside. They had held on to the primitive emotions which he, in bracket Smith, himself had to relearn by conscious effort. Everywhere stood the same solid, unconquerable figure, made monstrous by work and childbearing, toiling from birth to death and still singing. Out of those mighty loins, a race of conscious beings must one day come. You were the dead. Theirs was the future. Contrary to what Goldstein has said, that the proles will be incapable of rebelling because there is no way in which discontent can become articulate, the songs of the proles incorporate the primitive emotions and do articulate, however roughly, the proles' hope, though they do not yet know it. Describing how Winston is listening to the washerwoman sing, Orwell tells us that there are everywhere all over the world hundreds of thousands of millions of people just like this, people ignorant of one another's existence, held apart by walls of hatred and lies, and yet almost exactly the same, people who had never learned to think, but who were storing up in their hearts and bellies and muscles the power that one day would overturn the world. The proles have made the songs their own and expressed through them what little individuality they have retained. Much of this emotional, if not intellectual, individuality results from the proles keeping touch with the reality beyond the party through their work. You could share in their future, Smith believed, if you kept alive the mind as they kept alive the body. The proles' more frequent contact with the physical world through manual labor helps them in maintaining a grip on reality and is crucial in withstanding the onslaught of the state's deception. Most specifically, newspeak. For, as Orwell wrote in The English People, the people likeliest to use simple concrete language and to think of metaphors that really call up a visual image, in brackets, through which the black-white world of newspeak can be challenged, end of brackets, are those in contact with physical reality. It is this concretely based imagery that must invade the party if the feeling individual is to survive. Winston sees such hope in Julia. Another excerpt. A thing that astonished him about her was the coarseness of her language. Party members were supposed not to swear, and Winston himself very seldom did swear, aloud at any rate. Julia, however, seemed unable to mention the party, and especially the inner party, without using the kind of words that you saw chalked up in dripping alleyways. He did not dislike it. It was merely one symptom of her revolt against the party and all its ways, and somehow it seemed natural and healthy, like the sneeze of a horse that smells bad hay. End of excerpt. Finally, then, and this is Orwell's concluding message, the battle for the future in the totalitarian society is between those who keep both heart and mind alive, though keeping touch with reality of the physical world, and those who surrender heart and mind to the reality of the party. This theme of Orwell's is best captured in the scene in which Winston tries to explain to Julia that even the past, if it survives anywhere, lives on in a few solid objects, no words attached to them, like that lump of glass there, and in the scene during their escape to the country. An excerpt. The thrush had alighted on a bush not 5 meters away, almost at the level of their faces. Perhaps it had not seen them. It was in the sun, they in the shade. It spread out its wings, fitted them carefully into place again, ducked its head for a moment as though making a sort of obeisance to the sun, and then began to pour forth a torrent of song. In the afternoon hush, the volume of sound was startling. Winston and Julia clung together, fascinated. The music went on and on, minute after minute, with astonishing variations, never once repeating itself, almost as though the bird were deliberately showing off its virtuosity. Winston watched it with a sort of vague reverence. For whom, for what, was that bird singing? No mate, no rival was watching it. What made it sit at the edge of the lonely wood and pour its music into nothingness? But by degrees the flood of music drove all speculations out of his mind. It was though it were a kind of liquid stuff that poured all over him and got mixed up with the sunlight that filtered through the leaves. He stopped thinking and merely felt. Back to the text. This is not an injunction to stop thinking, even though we could cynically point out that it is precisely because Winston Smith thinks so much that he ends up dead. Rather, it is a clear conviction that if our minds are to withstand the electronic world, we must periodically go back to nature and to things without utilitarian value. Oh, man. I hate to jump in here, but, you know, this is exactly where my mind's been going. You know, like, I threw my cell phone away, and I just wonder at what point I can just take the Internet and say, you know, adios. You know, maybe keep the computer around just as a word processor, but there'll come a time when I care not anymore. So let me read that again. This is not an injunction to stop thinking, even though we could cynically point out that it is precisely because Winston Smith thinks so much that he ends up dead. Here we go. Rather, it is a clear conviction that if our minds are to withstand the electronic world, we must periodically go back to nature and do things without utilitarian value. In them, and in their profusion at the simplest level, we see that although each tree is made of wood, each rock of minerals, each bird of flesh and blood, no two are exactly alike. Winston himself realizes this when he sees some tufts of loosestrife growing in the cracks of a cliff. One tuft was of two colors, magenta and brick red, apparently growing on the same root. He had never seen anything of the kind before. We see at once similarity and variation, that nature of which we are a part. The first does not preclude the second. Nature's myriad proofs of external reality give the lie to the daily cant of fanatics of political orthodoxy and their language, which evades concrete experience of anything outside the party's grasp. To escape the totalitarian mentality, then, says Orwell, we must develop the habit of participating in, or at the very least observing, the physical world. In so doing, we become conscious of the tree of man, each individual needful of the same nourishment, singularly rooted yet diverse. The knowledge of such diversity in the realm of nature breeds tolerance, also of diversity, in the realm of politics. And this final quote is taken from the collected essays, Journalism and Letters, of George Orwell, okay? And this will bring us to an end of this part 7. At any rate, spring is here, even in London, and they can't stop you enjoying it. This is a satisfying reflection. How many a time I have stood watching the toads mating or a pair of hares having a boxing match in the young corn and thought of all the important persons who would stop me enjoying this if they could. But luckily they can't. So as long as you are not actually ill, hungry, frightened, or immured in a prison or a holiday camp, spring is still spring. The atom bombs are piling up in the factories. The police are prowling through the cities. The lies are streaming from the loudspeakers. But the earth is still going round the sun. And neither the dictators nor the bureaucrats, deeply as they disapprove of the process, are able to prevent it. Amen. And that is the end of Chapter 10 of Orwell, The Road to Airstrip 1 by Ian Slater. This is also the end of The Road to Orwell, Part 7. Hope you're enjoying it. Looks like you are. And we'll see you next time around.
Please fasten your seatbelts.